so stupid, he comes across in front of me every single time he overtakes. Where does he want me to go off the track?
No! Stop talking to me in the braking zone!
New Garden dominates, Hamilton wins by a ton. We ask why the British fans spoil all the fun. Next up on Motorsport 101. And welcome back to Motorsport 101, episode number 48 here on SoundCloud and all the other usual audio formats where all good podcasts are available. I'm your friendly neighbour, that's Mr. Andre Harrison, and it's British Grand Prix weekend, and, you know, we're still kind of on the back of what was a crazy weekend of sports. Andy Murray won Wimbledon, Lewis Hamilton dominated the British Grand Prix and won, and Portugal bored everybody to submission in the football. Yay!
But Ronaldo hype, yeah. Yeah, we're going to be talking about that.
Fuck that guy. Right, moving on from football, let's introduce the other usual two panelists. First up in the red corner, Mr. Ryan King. Hello, sir.
Yeah, here to talk about our boy Newgarden dominating. Let's not talk about F1, please.
Unfortunately, this is unavoidable for at least the first 45 minutes of the show. God damn us all. Because, yeah, we don't really want to talk about Britain, but unfortunately it's got a lot of takeaways from it that we need to kind of discuss. It's kind of shit like that, but hey, what can you do? And in the other corner, in the blue corner, representing Dartford as ever, Mr. Adam Johnson. Hello, sir.
Some stuff happened, didn't it?
Yeah.
Some things happened. Just, like, is Newgarden just sat there like, guys, I've got one working arm. Can you, like, try harder now, plus? And it's very, like, we have British Grand Prix weekend. We are here, well, me and Dre are here in Britain, so here, yeah, home Grand Prix, great atmosphere, yay, best place in the world. Except they were worse than WWE smart crowds.
Yeah.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear.
No, wait.
Oh,
wait,
dear.
Wait, guys, sorry, breaking news just in. Graham Rahal has just finished the Iowa Corn 300.
don't you mean
still beat Connor Daly?
Yeah, still beat Connor Daly across the line.
Yeah, we'll talk about the IndyCar Iowa Corn 300 later on in the show, but we're also going to be talking about the British Grand Prix, and, you know, there's a whole heap to take
because
away from
we are
that.
Masochists.
Yeah, we are masochists. We'll talk about Lewis Hamilton winning this 47th career Grand Prix win by dominating the British Grand Prix. We'll be talking about the safety car start, and yes, more fans complaining about said safety car start, and my ingenious solution that might just solve the problem. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about the turn one of poor judgment. Johnson, I want a really dramatic sound effect over my voice for that segment, by the way.
That
has to happen.
Kind of like that.
Okay. We'll be talking more about.
I already have no time to edit this episode, so thanks.
You're welcome. We'll talk more about Max Verstappen, everybody's favourite driver now all of a sudden. We'll be talking about the disdain of the British fandom, and we'll be talking about Rosberg getting retrospectively punished by that team radio rule we all thought would never come into play last season. We'll also talk about the Iowa Corn 300, Joseph Newgarden's ridiculous performance in Iowa as he led 282 out of 300 laps en route to a dominant 10-second victory over Will Power in second, and his crazy finish to the race that was impressive. And we'll also talk about Tony Kanaan picking a fight with the tall American one and the context of how that may disrupt a certain first lady of Motorsport 101 and King's certain night out with said person. More on that later.
Wow. That's going to get people gossiping.
Yes, yes.
Way to make it sound completely...
Yeah, King's just like, thanks, the shipping is about to begin now.
Yes, who knew King likes them Texan?
Wait, what? First off, well, we had Jack the Jobber and Susie Kennedy being shipped on What Culture, and now it's going to be King and Sarah Connors.
I'm so evil, what can I say?
I hate you, Dre.
King is just readying himself for the death threats on Twitter now.
I love you too, King, don't worry. We'll also talk about Kimi Raikkonen's contract re-signing and the fact that it's pretty much killed any and all talk regarding silly season. We'll talk about the Top Gear series finale and Chris Evans quitting the show because unfortunately the inconvenient timing of last week's episode was meant that Top Gear had their season finale and then one day later Chris Evans quit the show and we're only talking about it now 8 days later. Sorry about that. It happens, unfortunately. And we'll be talking about the brand new series heading to this podcast very, very soon, the International Fantasy Draft. So stick around to the end of the episode if you want to hear more about that. So that, and inevitably a whole lot more on Motorsport 101. And let's start with the highly motivational, encouraging, positive beacon of F1 hope that was the British Grand Prix. Yay. Yes, surprise.
That's a big silence.
Yeah, deafening silence. I think that just says it all, really. It was just such a mediocre Grand Prix. But Lewis Hamilton takes another victory, his fourth of the season, his fourth at Silverstone, becoming only the second man to win four times at Silverstone. Alan Prost holding that particular honour of five, being the all-time record. His 47th Grand Prix, and only four away from Alan Prost now, with 51 on the all-time wins list in third place where that's concerned. And King, the race was effectively over by the time the safety car pulled in two laps on. It was like Lewis Hamilton was not going to lose this Grand Prix by any stretch of the imagination, was he?
I don't know. I held out hope that the people who pitted in early would have had a shot, but that was, you know, effectively killed when the virtual safety car came out, when Pascal Wehrlein went off, and basically Hamilton and the rest of the leaders effectively got a free pit stop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we'll talk about that a little bit more in a minute, but I know a lot of the ham capers out there have flooded my inbox to say, Dre, what did you make of Hamilton's first lap? And off the radar because of the incident, because I think this was off the radar a lot, mostly because of people pitting for intermediate tyres, and obviously the first lap of a wet restart is always going to be captivating. Hamilton had a 3-second lead by the time he got through Luffield, which is just crazy that he was able to put that kind of gap on. And people have drawn the comparison to Donington 1993.
Oh my Christ. Oh God. I'm sorry, you're on a gavel bashing time. I'm sorry. Were you going to finish a sentence?
Go on, Johnson. It's all yours.
This is like, I swear this is a recurring theme. Do we have to justify everything by the holy thou name of thine holy saviour, Prince Senna? Literally, it's like, well, it's great. Senna did it. He did a thing like Senna, therefore he is God.
The comparisons are just far away, really, are they?
That's, I mean, true, but do you want to just go back and watch the tape of Donington 93 again? It's been played enough times in highlight reels.
You think
I
that,
understand.
Right?
But yeah. But what you might want to know, I mean, I know it's easy because Senna had just holy shining light, a beacon of holiness out of him all the time. But there were other cars on the track.
Yes.
And he overtook cars. He overtook a lot of cars in half a lap at Donington, which I'll argue is actually a harder track to overtake at than Silverstone in relatively modern F1 cars. So ham capers, chill. He had a clear track in front of him, greasy conditions, but the safety car basically enabled him to back the field up and then sod off. He was in control of the restart, so he got most of that jump, I'd wager, within about two corners, because he went straight away, and Rosberg and Verstappen and everyone behind had to react to that.
This is less ham capers and more Andrew Benson, who's like the lead ham caper at this point.
So BBC F1... Well, he's just disappointed Fernando Alonso's not doing anything, so he switched over to Hamilton.
People forget in 93, Senna actually started fourth, but got blocked, but basically couldn't get around Schumacher to start and drop to fifth.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So he then ended up passing four cars in, what, three quarters of a lap at Donington, which is fairly impressive. As I say, I think Donington's actually narrower. It's more hilly. It's not flat like Silverstone. So, yeah, chill out. I mean, it was a good first lap. But, like, this is classic Hamilton fan behavior. I mean, Benson obviously is a respected F1 journalist. I take the point. But, like, you don't need to over-egg the pudding. This was a great Hamilton performance. Chill. We get it. You do not need to justify his thine holy greatness upon us.
Have we forgotten one thing?
It is his world and we are merely living within it.
Yeah, we've all forgotten that Hamilton is basically ridiculous round Silverstone in the first place anyway. Like, we've forgotten, like, 2008 where he, like, completely obliterated the field in the rain.
Like, this is his house.
To the point where I think only three people were on the same racing lap as Hamilton that day. Like, it was one of the great individual performances in F1 history. So I'm not surprised Hamilton did that at all. He's always been strong in the wet, and he's always been strong around Silverstone. So don't get me wrong. I'm not saying it's not impressive, but I will also say that people need to chill a little bit on this one and accept the fact that Hamilton isn't the holy beacon of all things that, you know, that happened to grace Formula One. I get it. Like, Hamilton, it's a home Grand Prix. People are going to be excited about him, but we need to chill on this shit. Anywho, we're talking about Hamilton restarts because the race started behind the safety car, and it was the second safety car start in three races, and obviously we had one at Monaco earlier this year, and we had another one here that I think was the first, I want to say, six laps are behind the safety car.
Yeah.
And of course, the fans all, you know, completely shit on this, and, you know, of course they have every right to, and I get it, I get the frustration, I get why people would be upset by this, but I think in the context of Silverstone, given that it chucked down with rain like 10 minutes before the race was meant to start, and there was a bunch of fresh water on the circuit, I'm totally okay with a safety car start in this context, given the sudden nature of the downpour. I mean, what do you make of it, King?
From a lot of circles, it's pretty much in agreement that there should have been a safety car start, but it seems like where most fans are getting angry about this is that the safety car was out there for so long that by the time the safety car...
It was. It basically made the wet tires completely redundant. Yeah, literally.
By the time the safety car came in, there was no need for wet tires.
Yeah, there was. And, you know, Sebastian Vettel made that point after the Grand Prix. He said, well, what's the point of the extreme wets if we only use them for a safety car start and we're only restarting races when the track is fully, when the track is not fully wet and intermediate to the race tire of choice? Hence why we saw half the field dart into the pits at the end of the first green flag lap to pit for intermediate tyres. I was actually begging for Seb to pit during the safety car, put himself at the back with inters and see if he could try and pass some people.
But here's another point, though. King, you might be able to back me up on this. Aren't you only allowed to run wet tyres under the safety car start? Are you only forced to start the race on wet tires under safety car, and then as soon as one lap goes by, you can pit in and change them?
Yeah,
do you have to stay on those tires for the duration of the safety car?
If it's declared a wet start, you have to start on wet tires. You can't start on inters during a wet start.
Okay, but my question is, can you say start on the wets, and then if the safety car's still out on lap two, can you pit in whilst the safety car's still out and then put inters on?
Ooh, I'm not sure about that. You can't.
Because I'm sure someone would have, like, at least someone at the back, someone like one of the Manners or the Renaults or something. If I'm one of them, surely, if that's possible, I would have tried it.
Yeah, like,
what have you got to lose?
I'm stunned nobody tried it, and that might be the reason why. They might just not be allowed. I don't know.
I'm thinking there must be a reason. Hang on.
You would
to
be,
Twitter.
You would, in theory, be allowed, but you would, you know, give up all those positions, and you would have be forced to start at the back.
Yeah. What I'm saying is, wouldn't it be like a team like a Manor or a Renault, someone who qualified near the back anyway? It would make sense for one of them to try it.
You would have to be 100% certain that the race would not be started until it would be intermediate conditions. Like,
seen that three times now, King. We've seen that at Monaco, we saw it at Japan in 2014, where by the time the safety car comes in, the track is at intermediate level already. Which kind of defeats the entire purpose of the extreme wets at this point.
Yes, it does.
So, you know, I'm surprised, given that we've had three of these safety car starts in Formula One now, that no one has tried it, unless there is a rule saying you can't switch in the middle of that initial period. I don't know.
For me, like, even if it was allowed, I wouldn't do it. Because behind a safety car, you're allowed to race back to the, you know, back of the line, and I wouldn't put my driver out there in wet conditions on intermediate tires and tell him, go as fast as you can to catch the back of the field.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, is it worth the gamble? Maybe if you're at the back already or near the back already, maybe you can try it. I mean, in the case of a Seb fandom guy here, he was in 11th when the race started. So I thought, hey, why not just go to the back and see what you can do on the inters? You know, if you get it effectively, you'd get a free pit stop. And if everybody changes to inters, you'd be leading the race. So, little things like that. I'm surprised nobody tried it, but I have an ingenious solution to which I'll get to in a minute, because as King quite rightly alluded to, Pascal Wehrlein beached his car, I think, on the second lap of the restart, and as a result, half the field who had pitted in early for intermediate tyres, except for Sergio Perez, who as a result, because Sergio Perez is like literally the luckiest man on earth, got the free pit stop bonus and got up from like 10th to 4th as a result of the restart.
That was the one thing I was like, oh, the VSC is going to ruin the race now. Oh, Perez is in 4th, suddenly I'm cool with it.
Of course you are. Half the field had come in for intermediate tyres by the end of the first green flag lap, and as a result, their advantage had been wiped out because they could only drive at virtual safety car speeds because the virtual safety car came out for Pascal Wehrlein's accident, and that effectively gave the leaders a free pit stop. And as a result, by the time we got to lap 15, there was 37 seconds covering the top 10 in the field, and King, it pretty much ruined the race before it had even gotten started.
Yeah, pretty much. Like, any chance that any of the early pitters had about, you know, switching to intermediates earlier than everyone else was destroyed because the leaders got a free switch to intermediates because behind the virtual safety car, they could effectively pit and lose next to no time.
Exactly. Hey, King. Sorry to interrupt, guys. I've just posted the question on Twitter as we're taping this. Fan of the show, friend of the show, Danny Brennan's just tweeted back saying, no, they are not allowed to pit in until the safety car comes in. So that explains it. Which is a bit frustrating. I think had that rule not been there, I'm pretty sure someone like at least one of the Manners, maybe the Renaults, someone would have gambled. There's always someone who's prepared to roll the dice. And normally, if someone's at the back there, then they're more prepared. Because as you say, what have they got to lose? They're down the back anyway.
Yeah, so thankfully, cheers, Brennan. Much appreciated, sir. Big fan of the show as ever. Thanks, Danny. Much appreciated, sir. So I'm glad that... I mean, you're absolutely right. I thought, logically speaking, you'd have thought somebody would have tried it by now. But now we know why, because you literally can't try it. But I have a solution to this problem. I think this is my Prime Minister speech right here for Formula One, how to fix this problem. It reminds me a lot of, I don't think King remembers this, but the MotoGP race at Assen a couple of years ago, which had a sudden downpour of about 5 minutes to go before lights out. Now, Dorna had postponed the start, and here's what they did. My idea is going to be something similar to this. They delayed the start for 10 minutes, and what they did was they gave the field two extra formation laps, so you could go out there on the track, explore the track, and see what tyres you could go on, whether you judged it to be wet or dry, make the decision, and then have the race start from the grid, but with the bikes on with their preferred choice of bike. So if you felt like the track was dry enough, you could start on the dry tyres and not lose any time. If you felt like the wet bike was more appropriate, you could do that. The track was wet enough so that everybody was on the wet bike anyway, so it didn't really matter in that regard from a competitive standpoint, but it worked, and you know, we still had a great race, and it was a flag-to-flag race that Marc Marquez would go on to win. I propose something similar. You can have a safety car start, but the safety car start only lasts for two laps, and you have an open pit lane, so you can change tyres if you wish, the obvious sacrifice being that if you do that, you're giving up track position and starting from the back. The safety car comes in at the end of lap two, and it's a green flag pretty much no matter what, unless the conditions are like monsoon quality, like Canada 20.
In which case, you don't need to start the race.
But I'm pretty sure we almost had this. We almost had this. Remember, they tried to make it a rule that we would have had safety car grid restarts for safety car yellows.
When was this?
Remember?
Oh, last year. Bernie's great. Yay, let's make it F1 interesting by... It was in the same category as let's put sprinklers at the side of the fucking track.
It was like legitimately going to be a thing. And basically at the last second, because of fan outcry, the teams decided to veto it. Like, at first I was completely against it, but then I decided like it would be a good thing because, you know, rolling restarts in F1 are basically so uneventful. No overtaking ever happens. It's not like
I was gonna say, and I think
unless someone really shits the bed, do you ever get a restart overtake?
Yeah, I mean, like Hamilton. Part of the reason, as I said, part of the reason he had such a god tier first lap is that he controlled the restart. He backed everyone up, sodded off. Rosberg was a good half a second, nearly a second down on him within two corners because that's what the leader does. It's not like NASCAR where you are double file on the restart and they have to try and make rules to stop the leader getting screwed on the restart. So
yeah.
it's
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of the only problem I can see with that, Dre, it's a very good idea. I like it. The only problem with that is I think a lot of people did have a bit of a beef with the fact the safety car start took away the standing start element. So
yeah.
I like the idea of the formation laps and the sighting laps. I kind of go back to something that happened in V8 supercars back in 2007 at Oran Park. And it was one of the most eventful races I think I've seen in that division. Basically what happened, the rain arrived so late, they were on the first formation lap when the rain started coming down. And literally they gave them an extra two formation laps. They were only going to do one to come back round to the grid. Mm-hmm. Gave them an extra two, and they let drivers pit in. Some people had put wets on the grid, predicting the rain coming. Like five cars had put wets on the initial grid. Everyone else obviously was on dries, and they basically went, right, okay, judge what tyres you want, except if you pit, you're going to have to start from the pit lane. And basically what happened is I think half the remaining guys were like, okay, let's try this. They went for the original standing start. Obviously, the guys on wet tyres sodded off. The guys on slicks were like, nah, fuck this, we're coming in. And obviously, the other half of the field pitted and took the start from the pit lane. So basically, I think what we're advocating here is that the safety car start is a little bit too mummying, you know, babying. Do you know what? It's a little bit too like, no, we can't trust you. No, all wets, behave yourself, line up behind the safety car now.
They do have a bit of, you know, backing to say that they can't trust the drivers.
I completely agree with that notion. Like,
of course, yeah, no, I know.
I mean, trust it as far as you can throw them, quite frankly.
But, I mean, part of, I think what I'm saying as well is that you got to give the drivers something. They are at least smart for the most. They're gonna take risks to a degree, but I think you've got to give them some sort of. I like the idea of the formation laps, and then you let them choose the tyres they start on. If they have to start from the pit lane because they've changed tyres, that's their risk. I kind of like the idea. You also give them the sighting laps to kind of give them an idea, and then if the drivers are going, shit, guys, we can't race on this, then they're like, well, okay, what do we do now? Do we have to do the first few laps under safety car? I mean, the first hour of Le Mans this year was almost entirely under safety car because of monsoon conditions. But I think those formation laps also give the drivers a sense of going, well, you know, is this raceable on? Can we do this? Mm-hmm. Ultimately, if you tell drivers you're going racing, they're going to go racing. They're not going to say no because drivers never back out of anything. But they are going to say, look, there's standing water. There's things around here. I think my big beefs with it were, A, it took away the standing start, which I think took away a lot of the intrigue at the start of such a race, especially in such conditions. And B, it cost us six racing laps.
Yeah.
I mean, it didn't need to, surely.
I'm inclined to agree with that. Yeah.
As I say, the big problem was, it was a huge rain shower. Yeah, it looked brutal when David Coulthard and Mark Webber were getting their suit jackets soaked on the grid. But literally, as the time the safety car was rolling off to start the race, the sun was back out. And within four laps, the track was drying to the point that inters were needed. It kind of felt really unnecessary. So in this case, a couple of formation laps, a couple of sighting laps, the drivers would have gone, oh, sun's back out, looks like it's going to dry up, we'll probably have to start on wets. Maybe some drivers go, nah, we're fancy inters, okay, you can start from the pit lane and then go. I think that would have, we'd still had a sort of intriguing start to the race that way. I think too much was taken away the start played
out. It's very much like the Sachsenring in MotoGP a couple of years ago when Stefan Bradl was the hipster that basically started on the wet bike when the track was already drying out. And remember, you may have seen the picture of like two-thirds of the field in the pit lane ready to go on their dry bikes. So the wet guys had a head start and the dry guys had to chase them all down and ended up, it did eventually dissolve into the Marquez versus Pedrosa fight because the Daxton Ring's all about that in MotoGP, but that's what it was. Like, Bradl was the only one on a wet bike when the track was blatantly already dry enough. So, you know, Bradl got gobbled up because he was on a hybrid. He was like, oh, he was on the steel brakes like he was on a wet bike, but he had the dry tires on, and he was apparently losing like 20 meters in braking space every corner. So as a result, it completely ruined his race, and you know, the gamble just didn't quite pay off in his case. But yeah, that was my ingenious idea. I'll send it through to Parliament. I have to talk about Max Verstappen for a bit here, and
do we? Actually, I think no. For once, internet, we will please you because we think he is worthy of hype this time around.
Yes.
Yes, look, I take no pleasure from this, okay?
But actually, can I just say, before you get going on this, we were just talking about this before the start of the show. Sorry, it's what I do around here. We were talking about this in the past few weeks. You had your sort of Ferrari meltdown of sort of, oh, God, it becomes harder and harder to support Ferrari. And I was like, mate, I support Force India. My expectations are on the floor. And I had a good weekend, I've got to say. But we were talking about how
in a serious point, we were talking about how no team has really been able to capitalize on Ferrari's weaknesses this year. Is it fair to say that of all the people that have capitalized the most on Mercedes' vulnerabilities, it's not been Ferrari, certainly not been Williams, it's not been Daniel Ricciardo, it's been the 18-year-old Verstappen in his third Grand Prix in a Red Bull. He has been the one that every single time has been there to maximize Mercedes' mistakes. He's capitalized on them every single time.
It's annoying. Like part of the hype makes me want to see this kid crash and burn, but at the same time, he is answering every single question that every critic is firing at him. He's, as King quite rightly pointed out, he's scored 77 points since he joined Red Bull in Catalunya. And in those rounds, he's finished first, and he's had a pair of second places. Well, he's the only man who's not a Mercedes to win this season. And, like, Verstappen keeps answering these questions, and King, he was at it again with a spectacular pass before the hanger straight on Nico Rosberg during the race. It was sensational.
Yes, like, oh god, like, I hate this phrase so much, and I rarely ever use it for anyone, but Verstappen really proved that he's a future world champion.
How much did that burn you, King?
Oh, so much. I think, like, the last person I, like, called a future world champion was, like, back in 2008, like, Robert Kubica. Like, that was the last person I called a future world champion. It's been a long, long time.
Sorry, Verstappen, you're done. Enjoy your career in rallying.
King has cursed you now. King has cursed you to all in degrees. But, I mean, it was a spectacular pass from probably the pass of the season so far from Max Verstappen. Rosberg was caught completely cold, and that was the main highlight of the race. It was the Verstappen versus Rosberg fight, and I have to say, props to the FIA on this one, before I bashed them later on in the episode. They got the DRS absolutely spot on for this round. The DRS down the back of the hangar straight was just enough to bring a car into play, but it didn't guarantee a pass. You still had to work for it, and that's exactly what DRS should be in today's F1, and I think it was fantastic. So, you know, pat on the back to the FIA for that one.
It basically meant that DRS wasn't a gimme. Like,
no, it wasn't.
You didn't just blow past the guy on the straight. It just helps you set up for a deep braking maneuver into the end, into the next corner, which is excellent.
Indeed, and that's exactly what it should be. And to be fair, I think Max Verstappen was a bit of a naughty boy during this race, doing a lot of what I believe were double weaves, like Rosberg complained about. But again, no one listens to when a driver complains ever in Formula One, because we all just think they're being whiny bitches. But Verstappen did double weave quite a lot during that race. And, you know, we saw in Austria, I think it was Kevin Magnussen get a 5-second time penalty for excessively weaving and pushing a guy off the track. So, King, I have to ask once again, where's the consistency here in this stewarding? Like, why does this keep happening, bro?
Oh, God. Like, I would say it's mainly because there isn't, like, a permanent set of stewards for each race. It's not like like in North America, where you have in IndyCar and NASCAR, they have the same set of people in race control for the entire season. In F1, it's different race to race, and that's kind of it's kind of weird in today's world, where, like, FOM uses the same set of cameramen for every race, but when it comes to race stewarding and marshalling, it's a different set of people at each venue.
Not exactly ideal, and when you're running different stewards at every weekend, you're going to get inconsistencies. But hey, you know, it made for a captivating second half of the race. So hey, I'm not going to complain too much about that. But you know, steward inconsistency, never going to happen. Not in a million years. Also, Johnson, we have to mention this. Turn one of poor judgment. How many guys just completely lost their car at Abbey this weekend into turn one? And to be fair, the drivers, for the most part, did a spectacular job of saving it a lot of the time. They're not turning it into a complete disaster. I think only Alonso and Wehrlein had accidents on that corner that ended up being terminal. But it was kind of crazy, wasn't it, Johnson?
Just a little bit, yeah. This was like a little bit of D1 Grand Prix exhibition turned up at F1. And what caused it was, in essence, quite sort of a similar problem as to what completely crippled the Grand Prix of Louisiana last year in IndyCar, where they had a track that was drying out, but there was still it was too dry to run any wet tires, except there were still some pretty large wet patches elsewhere around the track that if you touched, your car was completely going off into the wall. So they couldn't get more than one lap going because someone would crash. And literally here, it was just lucky that the wet patch in general, it was just off to the left of the racing line going into the right hand.
And it would not dry out.
It just wouldn't dry out. It was still there at the end of the race. And if you just clipped your left rear on that, as nearly everyone did, you were going sideways. And I tell you what, I think Hamilton, even Hamilton nearly lost it there. Yep. I mean, seriously, it was not immune to it. And it was like, this is how you could tell this was Hamilton's race. They made the big fuss of, oh, Hamilton's made a mistake. Verstappen made the mistake exactly the same lap. Yeah. So it's literally like, oh, even when Hamilton trips up, it was his race from the start, let's be real. But I mean, I think ultimately there was a lot of impressive driving down there. I think my boy Perez wins it though. He was four-wheel drifting out, literally mashing the throttle, just staying out of the gravel trap. And for once, I think we have to give some props to the asphalt runoff as well, because I think had that not been there, we would have ended up with 15 cars in the kitty litter at turn one.
Yep. The asphalt runoff did its job, and shout out to Sergio Perez for doing his best Marco Melandri impression from Fit the Part, and where he's literally four-wheel drifting on the asphalt and still doesn't even touch the gravel. But Vettel had two spins there, Raikkonen had two, Verstappen had two excursions, Hamilton had one, Perez had one, Alonso had a big one, and that ended his race prematurely. Actually, no, he was able to save it, actually, my bad. Alonso was able to continue, my bad. I think the only one that was terminal was Pascal Wehrlein. I think, actually, no, Harrianta had one as well. Harrianta had one that put him out of the Grand Prix. Some manner had two near identical accidents that put both their cars out of the Grand Prix.
Though I have to admit, I saw some of the people in the purist camp saying that there should be more gravel. See, gravel isn't dangerous, and they're not even being punished to the people who run out on the asphalt. They're only losing two or a couple seconds.
Did they really want to have a Grand Prix with six cars left running by lap 30?
Exactly.
That's what we'd have had here. I mean, seriously, in this case, I didn't have much of a problem with it. I think what was quite funny was seeing some people either try risking just cutting straight back onto the track as soon as possible over the little grass verge of the grass run-up, or just keep going all the way around to about turn three before finally rejoining the track. I think that's the line Raikkonen took. He was just like, I do not care. I am making my own racetrack now. I'm off in Narnia. Oh, hey, I'm back now, finally. But, I don't know.
Yeah, one of those things, but you know, the purists will be annoyed. I am not totally against the idea of supposedly, in inverted commas, punishing the drivers. We'll get to that later. But on the same hand, I don't think these measures should be trying to deliberately put cars out of the race, like the sausage curbs on the outside of Turn 8 at Austria a couple of weeks ago. That was some bullshit. So I'm somewhat on the fence regarding that, but we had to mention turn one because that shit was ridiculous.
Yeah, like Abby showing like why I love that corner. It's probably my favorite corner on the calendar, to be honest.
It's a really nice corner. It is a really, like, that's the one thing about the redone Silverstone I actually like.
Yeah, I agree.
Everything else can
bring back Bridge.
Yes, we have to have Bridge back. I don't care how. If this has to happen.
Well, I think there was some sort of layout. I remember playing this on Grid Autosport a little while back. There was some sort of layout where it was like, I think it was the layout maybe for the 2009 or 10 British Grand Prix, where they hadn't finished the new pit section, which is now the main start-finish straight, even though it looks the same as the old start-finish straight on the TV, which always looks confusing, especially on the final lap. And they had some sort of, in that game, they had a sort of weird hybrid thing where basically, instead of, you know where you turn right at Abbey, you basically turn left, quite a tight little left chicane, and then right, and you rejoin the old circuit just as you go down the hill towards Bridge.
Yeah, that's the way the layout went.
Yeah, pretty much. I was like, I like that format. Why didn't we keep that one?
Gotta get more £500 ticket seats in there, Johnson. That's clearly the idea.
True.
Speaking of fans and ticket prices, look, man, those guys that aren't British that listen to us, I'm sure you've probably worked out by now that me and Johnson are the British guys on this show. King is the only American, and King is the disciplined, well-natured one for the next 5 minutes. But
Yeah, this is where we abandon any pretenses of being like, oh, we're the Brits who like America. We want to be American. No, we're proper Brits this time because, yo, our people, we need to have a chat.
Yeah, like, okay, I'm going to make this evidently clear. This is like a preview before, like, this is like a 2-day preview before the next Dre Brief episode comes out. And I'm going to say this loud and I'm going to say this proud. Stop booing the fucking drivers, you assholes. Stop it. It's really fucking stupid, okay? I've had it with this. I've absolutely had it to my wit's end with this. Now, a lot of this is down to my own bitterness because, as you well know, I'm a Sebastian Vettel fan and I had to deal with half a season of this. Now, we all remember Multi-21, right? And we all know that, like, I've still found it amazingly hypocritical that fans booed Sebastian Vettel, not only because he kept winning, which is just horseshit in its own right and just so disrespectful, but also because, like, in Formula 1, we supposedly hate team orders, right? We supposedly hate team orders of a moment in passion and we want to see the drivers race. So let me get this straight here. The guy that broke team orders gets booed because you've got to respect the decision, right? That's the logic we had here. And it was awful. And Vettel got booed for like 10 straight rounds all the way through to Singapore that year, where like basically everybody had enough of it. Like I think it was like Ross.
Was that the one where Martin Brundle was like, oi, pack it in?
Yeah, Brundle did the podium interview that day and Brundle said, you know, he said, no, that's not right. And it stopped because like, all the like the big prominent figures in F1 said it was nonsense. He said it. Nico Rosberg said it. You know, Lewis Hamilton said it.
Hamilton say it? Yeah.
Like they all said the boom was ridiculous. He's done nothing wrong. He's doing his job properly, and it's up to us to beat him. So like when Lewis Hamilton is the voice of reason, then you know this is getting ridiculous, quite frankly. So that was a thing, and I thought we were through this for the most part. We had it at Belgium 2014 when Rosberg hit Hamilton, which I thought that was nonsense because it was just a racing incident, in my opinion. We had it 2 weeks ago in Austria when, and I think, don't get me wrong, I'm not going to bury the fans on this one so much because there is many stories going around that the trackside commentator tried to blame Hamilton for the incident, which was, again, was complete horseshit. And I still, I mean, it may have proved that some of their fans there were sheep by listening to the trackside commentator and just saying, oh, boo, because, you know, his word is you know, most important when I'm sure the big screens could show a replay. And if he showed the replay, it was more than obvious Hamilton was in no way to blame for that accident. And we got it again. Like, Rosberg was booed not only during the podium where he collected his second place trophy, but also even as early as the Thursday, where he's coming out to the fans to sign autographs, going on the F1 show, going on TV, you know, spending time with the fans and whatnot. And I can't get my head around this. Like, I get it. You're spending your hard-earned money to go to this Grand Prix. I get that. But to me, and, you know, you have your right to do this. You spend your money, to a degree, you have a right to do this. But I'm sorry, this is me as a human being with some respect. If you're going out of your way to spend your money, to drive down on a Thursday to a Grand Prix venue, to throw shade and to boo at any driver, this is not just a Hamilton thing, that any driver, I think you're a complete prick. I just do. I can't get around this. I can't give people a pass for this. I think it's bullshit that this is a thing. And it makes our sport look so petty and childish that this is a thing still. Like, these are grown men and women that are adults that are deliberately booing the driver for literally no reason. It's... King, make me take a breath here, please, because I can't take...
Well, can I chime in first as the other Brit here?
Go on.
Thank you. Like, to me, this feels like an attempt to almost, like, for the British fans to treat this like football. Newsflash, it isn't. In the same way that people complaining or telling people to suck it up, you lost after the Brexit vote result, need to realise that politics isn't fucking football either. Motorsport isn't fucking football.
No.
This is not a case of, you know, this is literally, it's almost a case of pantomime, but there was almost a nasty edge to it as well. Do you know what I mean? Fuck you element.
This is carried over from a race that was a week ago. This isn't panto. These are people that have gone out of their way to do this on purpose.
Yeah.
It came on Thursday to boo him. Thursday!
when he's out there signing autographs for the fans, if I was him, I'd just be like, well, sod you then. I'm going back in, going back to my trailer. It's warm in there.
But you know what the problem
I have to say out here for you, motherfuckers.
But you know what the problem is, though? If he did that, he's going to get booed even more. He's going to be seen like he's...
Oh, I was just waiting for him on the podium. As soon as he was getting showered in booze, I'd have loved him just to pull a willpower double bird and storm off. I'd just to be like, fuck you, I don't care. I'm turning heel.
Play the heel.
Like, proper, like... Just go for it.
Said
like,
it after Austria. Play the heel. Like, I
mean, proper like Bret Hart style. Just shoot on the crowd. Like, you never supported me. You never backed me. Have your homeboy. I don't care.
The problem is that Nico
and
Rosberg...
And he would have been probably entitled. Go
the
on,
problem
go
is that Nico Rosberg's, like, far too nice and open to the fans and so loving of the fans
yeah, that's
to
the
play
problem.
The heel.
Like, how can you boo him? He's lovely. He's so
one
nice.
The,
like,
one of the genuine gentlemen and real nice guys of form. I've never heard a bad story against Nico Rosberg as a human being ever. The fact that I remember during the test earlier this year, after being interviewed by Craig Slater for Sky Sports F1, he was driving around the paddock to find a fan he was going to come back to after committing to an interview. The man is a proper professional and a true gentleman. He's one of the least deserving drivers in this field to get booed. At all. I think it's complete horse shit. I don't know.
I think it's literally a case of hey, he did bad things to British driver. He German, boo.
Damn.
Yeah, he take away. And it's just that sort of tribal instinct. I think what's worse, though, what's absolutely worse, is that we rightly condemned the booing at Austria for Lewis Hamilton because I don't think he deserved that either. This is not a case of Hamilton deserved it. This is not biased.
Like people, like
no.
I want to make this very clear for a second here, Johnson. I had a fair few people tweet me yesterday saying, "Oh well, aren't you guys condoning the Hamilton boos from last week?" No.
Did you not read our Twitters then?
Yeah, you can listen back on the podcast or see any of our tweets. We condemn that too.
No.
I'm the same person who still doesn't believe why people...
I told all the fans being Hamilton that weekend to go fuck themselves. I had no problem admitting that. And I got to say a big shout out to Sarah Connors, the first lady of Motorsport 101, as I like to call her now, for basically calling this a week ago when she said all these people that are condoning these Hamilton boos are going to boo Rosberg next week, and that's exactly what happened.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Any British fans, you can't get on your high horse about people booing your boy Hamilton when you do exactly the same to his teammate next week. It's still his teammate, for God's sake. Like, seriously, this is a guy who, if... Let's be real here. If Mercedes had a genuine threat and it was Hamilton versus, say, Vettel or Massa or something for the championship... I have a feeling Rosberg would probably end up playing the good teammate, don't you?
Yes.
If he was in no chance for the championship, he'd still be a good teammate here. As we said, this guy's a decent bloke. Like, and ultimately, what has he done wrong except try to win races and championships? This is almost as bad as back in 2005 when Jeff Gordon had cans of beer thrown at him at Talladega just by daring to beat Dale Earnhardt Jr., in Alabama. He was just like, oh, it's nice. Yeah, it's
like I said, it's double standards. Like, we've seen people pull desperate lunges in Formula 1 before. It happens in MotoGP almost every other round, for God's sake. Like, this is... You can't beat that narrative drum of the driver doing everything it takes to win and condemn the guy that does it. I think that's nonsense. In the same way that I said back in 2013, you can't condemn team orders and then boo the guy who breaks them. You can't have this both ways. So... I honestly was appalled by the British fans. And you know, if you're one of those guys that were out here...
Even when Hamilton was trying to quell the dissent as well, he actually tried. He said, oh, these fans are really great. There's no need to do this. Literally, they responded with even louder boos. I'm just like, oh, fuck off. I mean, really?
I said it on Twitter. Hamilton would be ashamed by your booing. He gets it.
You're not carping to Hamilton here. You're like, oh, yeah, we love you, Hamilton. Look how much we love you by booing the shit out of your teammate.
Yeah,
he's just sitting there going, well, you jerks, really.
But it always seems like the British Grand Prix has always been the madhouse Grand Prix, whether it be the crowd storming the track after Mansell's win or
I do wonder if it's the sort of football fan mentality. I don't know if that's the sort of thing. Like, I'm not saying it's like
the nature of British working class people, and maybe a bit of German xenophobia thrown in for good measure. Maybe
a tiny bit. Yeah, I'm not throwing the shade at football fans. I mean, hell, I am one. But you know, like a little bit of that incredible. Yeah, of course. But that's sort of. You know how it is, how naturally in football it becomes very tribal. You know, you go after your club, you go after your team. Do you know what? You back your team. To the hilt, almost blindingly so at times. So
yeah,
I do wonder if there's.
I would say this is normally the Hamilton thing, but it isn't because Vettel got booed there 2 years, 3 years ago in 2013 when his car conked out on the home straight. when he had the gearbox failure. He was sarcastically...
Yeah, and I'm sorry, that's the lowest of the low. You should never wish harm or ill on a guy. It's a bit like the guys celebrating when Cristiano Ronaldo got injured in the Euro 2016 final. I'm like, seriously, fuck off.
Shit. I'm sorry. If you're a football fan, how could you not want Ronaldo to perform 90 minutes to his best in that final? That's what we kind of are here for here. Yeah. We want to see the best players in Europe play a good game of football. So, I don't see how taking Ronaldo off the field makes the situation any better. So, British fans, we're meant to be the biggest core of hardcore F1 fans on the planet. We need to do better. We need to do better than this. We need to set an example, not further embarrass ourselves after the debacle that was the Austria podium last week. We need to do better than this. If you're a fan listening to this show and you booed one of the drivers, I want you to take a good hard look at the mirror and ask yourself this. Would your favourite driver, the guy that you hail a hero, would he be happy with you booing another driver? Would he endorse your behaviour? Because if you honestly think the answer to that question is yes, then I don't think this sport is for you. And I'd rather you not watch, because I think people like you are a stain, and I think you make the sport worse. And I take pride in being a Formula One fan, and I get embarrassed when I see large groups of fans pick on any driver and boo them to the hilt. I think it's disgraceful. So, speaking of disgraceful, and moving on to this... King, the floor is effectively yours here in a minute, because we found out that Nico Rosberg, after the race, about 3 hours after the race, which was actually a very late deliberation from the stewards on this, but it turns out Nico Rosberg had a gearbox issue in the last 10 or so laps of the race, and it seemed his seventh gear was not working. For the first time in Formula One history, the new radio rule had come into effect, because Mercedes violated that rule to tell Rosberg to put the engine in a particular setting and to avoid seventh gear. This was seen as an infringement on said rules, and Rosberg was punished with a 10-second time penalty, demoting him from second to third behind Max Verstappen, costing Rosberg 3 points. And... we've been waiting, I've been waiting for this rule to come into trial for quite some time, and it has, and this was the outcome. And King, I think this rule is complete horseshit. I mean, tell me what you make of this, and again, the floor is yours, say whatever the hell you want. Shut up, Johnson, for 2 minutes.
Okay, well, firstly, I gotta say, I completely agree with you, this rule's horseshit, and, oh god, this is another case of the FIA being able to be swayed by public opinion, because this rule only exists because the fans complained that they, were tired about hearing radio conversation calls.
Canada 2015 was the game changer, because if anybody doesn't remember that Grand Prix last year, sorry to cut you, King, but that was the Grand Prix where people complained massively about tire management being so predominant in Formula One, without realizing that management for cars has been a part of F1 for 30 plus years. But nobody likes to know how the sausage is made, so to speak, in this case. So as a result, I think a few rounds later at Singapore, they announced this new rule of you can't coach the drivers anymore unless it's a safety issue, and this was the first infringement. But yeah, carry on, King. Just a little bit of context in there.
Well, fans keep saying, oh, FIA and Bernie don't care about us, they don't listen to us. That's a complete lie. They do. If you complain about something enough, they'll, change the rules or ignore the rules. The 76 Grand Prix at Brands Hatch, where, the FIA completely ignored the red flag rules and let the crew of James Hunt work on his car to get him back in the race because they were afraid the British fans were going to continue rioting and if they, not let him re-enter the race. And this is the same case. They were, the fans complaining were so loud that they couldn't ignore it. They had to do something. And this was the simplest band-aid instead of doing anything significant to change how the sport is actually run. If they don't talk about it, then the fans don't know it's happening. So they decided to go down that path, and we ended up with this rule that they hoped would never be used, and it unfortunately came up.
Yeah, and the biggest issue I have with this, I hated this rule from the start, and I hated the rule, and I said it because like, this feels like a placebo effect, a placebo rule brought in to make us masochistic F1 fans feel better about the product we're watching. And, you know, because, you know, as Johnson very eloquently said last week, for all the talk about the tech in F1, we always will care most about the squishy bit behind the wheel. And we don't like seeing drivers have an easy time. There's been a narrative in Formula 1 for years for seeing drivers pushed to their maximum and, you know, seeing them push to their limits and, you know, seeing them work for it, basically, because we don't want F1 to come across like it's getting easier for people. We want people to make it seem like it's hard. Hence why I felt this war was a placebo. And...
yeah, and absolutely, just before you continue there, what I find interesting about this rule is that it seems to have been one born out of perception. And
absolutely.
Was there no way F1 could have changed it? Because if you think about it, this rule doesn't exist in any other sport. And we hear, week in, week out, in, you know, IndyCar and in NASCAR, I mean, hell, WEC, that's endurance racing, that's kind of what it's all about strategy, making sure you hit... you know, certain laps in terms of fuel and tires and driver stints, you know, times for driver stints and things like that. And we see in NASCAR, IndyCar, there are fuel mileage races where guys are being coached to say, oh, you've got about 10 laps left. You need to save fuel, need to back off. No one gets their knickers in a twist, proverbially speaking, about guys not going fast enough. Like, oh, they're not pushing 110% because they're trying to save fuel. But in NASCAR, that's a good... it's like, oh my God, he's actually trying to make it on fuel. This is actually really tense. And I'm, you know, hearing... like, for example, my favourite race, and a race that I'll actually pitch as one of the greatest motor races of all time, is the 2014 Bathurst 1000. And part of what makes the finish of that race so special is knowing that Jamie Whincup's laying the beat down on Chas Mostert, but you hear the radio messages on the TV broadcast of his engineer telling him, Jamie, you've got to start saving fuel. Jamie, we're not going to make it. Jamie, you've got to start backing off. You're saving fuel. Seriously, we're going to run out with half a lap to go. Start saving fuel. And you just, you hear the intensity start to ratchet up like that. And it properly gives you tingles. And I'm like, for Formula One, like, hang on, how does it translate into, oh, that's really boring. Like, it must be a perception issue. Yeah, and this rule appears to have just overcomplicated things. It hasn't really fixed it.
I think I would put it down to, you know, seeing the sausage maker for the first time, because it, compared to like NASCAR and IndyCar, the radio has always been open even before it was broadcast on TV. If you had
only had team radio for like 10 years in F1.
Yeah, if you had a radio scanner, you always had access to IndyCar, NASCAR radio. But in F1, their radio signals have always been encrypted. There was no way to know, and the PR has always been, they're on the limit, going 110% on the ragged edge. And finally, the FOM deciding,
we've got to look behind the curtain, and we realize, oh, that's kind of not the case. Although surely if you were a smart race fan, you'd kind of realize they didn't anyway.
We pushed for it, and we ended up seeing the FIA sausage.
Yes.
Simple as that.
That's not a visual I want to have.
No, exactly. And I'll be talking more about that in my Dre brief later this week. Actually, by the time you've listened to this, it's probably already out. But it's the sausage. It's the way the sausage is made. And the FIA have put themselves in a real corner here. And another reference I used to, if you're a Star Trek fan, you'll know this reference, where I called it the Kobayashi Maru, the unwinnable situation, where... in Star Trek, for instance, you know, like, it was Captain Kirk who rigged the test so he could actually find a way out. But it's either you save a Klingon ship and start a war, or you don't and you know your other crewmates will be killed. It's a lose-lose situation. And the FIA was basically in this pickle here. And they had to decide what was the punishment going to be for this rule infringement, which has never come up before until now. So there was no precedent to set before this. There was nowhere in the rules that said, if this rule is broken, this is the penalty. They chose a 10-second time penalty. Which is complete dog shit, because now... this precedent has been set where now every team in the paddock did not know before this Grand Prix, but now know that if you break this rule, you're getting a 10-second time penalty. Now, you ask any Formula One team or anyone with half a brain cell, quite frankly, at this point, if you tell them to take a 10-second time penalty or a problem that could prove terminal, like Rosberg's gearbox, who knows what could have happened if Rosberg was none the wiser, and you find out, oh, he's done damage to the gearbox. He's out of the race now. That's cost him, what, 18 points. What would a team choose? They'll take the penalty every single time, without question.
It's not guaranteed the next time it'll be 10 seconds, but you know for sure it's at a minimum 10 seconds. It could be, you know, disqualification be whatever the steward's pleasing be the maximum, but you know the minimum is going to be 10 seconds.
Yeah, and, you know, unless it's a minor problem, they're going to take the time penalty because that's better than a potential retirement. You know, there's risk assessment and all this, and teams are not going to take a risk on something like that. So now this precedent's been set, teams are going to violate this rule more often. I mean, there's a very good chance that, for example, in Baku, if they told Hamilton how to fix his engine, knowing the penalty was going to be 10 seconds, they'd have taken it because they lost bucket loads of time because of Hamilton's engine mode problems in that race in Baku. So it's an awful, awful rule, and I think you've got to scrap it now because teams are going to abuse this rule to the hilt from here on in if this continues. And it's an awful rule. I want it scrapped immediately. It was never a worthwhile rule to begin with. It was a placebo effect to keep the fans happy. And now we've seen the sausage maker, and I think it's time that we move on from it. But that's the long and the short of the British Grand Prix. And let's talk about something brighter and more positive, IndyCar. And King, you were not at home watching this Grand Prix, were you?
No, I watched it with our good friends Sarah Connor and Elizabeth Worth, and it was a fun time at a bar watching the race.
Can I just say... Yeah, go on, Johnson.
Before you go on, King, I hope you're fully aware that as we speak, there are keyboards being limbered up around the world to commence the first batch of Motorsport 101 fan fiction.
Oh, dear God.
What you are now responsible for is in 12 to 18 months, there is going to be fan fiction on the internet of me and Dre. And I apologize.
What?
This is how it starts.
Like, trust me. Like, okay, once you see King in a selfie with heart-shaped glasses, you know it's real, okay?
That is... Thank God.
I haven't seen this.
No, it doesn't exist. It doesn't exist. He just made that up.
He says whilst hastily deleting it off his phone.
Don't you?
Oh, goodness. The rumours are flying already. Yeah. The fan fictions are just being written, but waiting to be written.
Go on, King. I'm gonna send you deeper into a hole here, King. But how was your night?
Oh, it was fun. It was fun.
Tell us more. What I heard it took place during the Euro 2016 final as well, didn't it?
Oh, yeah. We saw the extra time from that, and that was intense. The bar lit up like fireworks when Portugal scored the winning goal.
Yep, exactly, and sod Portugal for that, but yep, he was there for the entire Grand Prix. Shout out to them, shout out to Lizzie and Sarah as always, but what he witnessed as well as us was the biggest motorsport in beat-em-downs I've seen since I started watching IndyCar at the beginning of 2015. I mean, I've been an IndyCar fan now for a season and a half, and I have not seen a performance as majestic as this. I mean, Johnson, at one point, he had nearly the entire field lapped. This was an unbelievable performance from Joseph Newgarden to win the Iowa Corn 300.
And, like, as I said back at the Road America review, I've seen a broken clavicle stroke collarbone injury close up. My father had bust his collarbone one time when he was playing rugby, and he could barely do his job, which is of a sign writer. He could barely write, even if it was on his... It wasn't his writing hand arm that was damaged. But it still massively affected doing his job, and it was agonizingly painful. He could barely sleep on it. It was just horrendous. And you take that into account, and add this to a performance at Road America, and then this, which would have been dazzling for a driver fully fit.
Mm-hmm.
And you literally run out of words straight away. I mean, what was quite funny about this race in a way was some people going, oh, well, the race is kind of boring. And I was like, no. I'm sorry. I know we like our entertainment. We kind of want to be spoilt for entertainment. We're almost a bit like Julius Caesar in the Colosseum with the thumbs up, the thumbs down. But I'm sorry. There are times we have to go, you know what? I'm cool with this not being the best pure entertainment spectacle, drama, blah, 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 game seven moments ever. Let's just sit back and marvel.
Yeah, like,
this is just an exhibition of fucking awesome driving, like, here. Seriously.
Us trio in Manhattan admitted that, yeah, this is a bit boring, but oh my God, Newgarden is destroying the Penske's.
There's always pleasure in a Penske being destroyed. There always is. I mean, we saw Montoya struggle and have an engine misfire. I mean, that was glorious. At one point, Newgarden, until the first caution, had a 13-second lead on championship leader Simon Pagenaud. He had lapped everybody else in the field. It's a shame that hard work was wiped out by the first caution, but every time there was a restart, Newgarden would just rack up the same lead over and over again. There was literally no answer for him. Like, they tried the aggressive lines on the restarts, couldn't happen. And once Newgarden got two laps to get his feet in, he was gone. It was simple as that. I mean, Pagenaud tried it. Power tried it. Dixon, who we thought might steal it late on because he's Scott Dixon, for God's sake. even he couldn't do it. And Newgarden ended up winning the race by about 8 seconds from Will Power in second in the end. And it was a completely dominant performance from start to finish. He led 282 out of 300 laps, which is a new Verizon IndyCar Series record that has never been done before. That works out at about 98% of the race.
Let's give this some context. In terms of dominant performances this year, the only one that I think can come close is Martin Truex Jr. at the Coca-Cola 600, yeah, where he led something like 380 of 400 laps. I mean, yeah, miles based twice as long, but Martin Truex Jr. was fully healthy, and the average speed for IndyCars is faster than stock cars. I'm sorry, I think Newgarden wins this one. This is
on a 17 second lap short oval as well.
Exactly, yeah, with the intensity is crazy. We had guys nearly wrecking into lap cars. It was claustrophobic. It was basically an IndyCar short track race, and there aren't words. That sort of concentration, that sort of focus, you've got to give props to his team as well to keep the car that good. It had to adjust to keep up with the track. The thing just wasn't, it wasn't like he started well and then faded and other guys caught up to him. He stayed that level of dominant and fast throughout the entire thing. Mm-hmm. It's a miracle.
An unbelievable performance. Again, as we mentioned, with a broken clavicle, the plate is still in his shoulder as we speak. It's the best IndyCar performance I've seen since I started watching the series, and it was so good that even the F1 guy was appearing like, wow, Newgarden did that. it was unbelievable. I mean, one also I want to draw on as well for a minute here is that guys like Paul Tracy on the commentary call was talking a lot about how Newgarden could be like the hot free agent going into next season. I mean, he signed a 2-year deal with Ed Carpenter Racing at the end of last season, which was a bit of a surprise because I think many of us thought he might be heading to Ganassi. King, if another big team comes knocking, will he be able to resist for a second year running?
I think it's going to also be an issue of where is there going to be an open seat.
I mean, there was a lot of talk about Tony Kanaan's number 10 car at Ganassi. Kanaan made a guarantee to Katie Hargett and the crew there that and the TV broadcast and NBC that he will be in IndyCar next year, but he could not guarantee with what team, which is interesting.
Well, I mean, he is 41 now, so, I mean, he's still quick as anything, but, yeah, it depends on what Ganassi are doing next up.
It's easy to forget that Kanaan is top six in the championship right now. Like, Kanaan's...
Yeah, exactly. He's the Kimi Raikkonen of IndyCar.
He will not go
the
away.
The old guy that people would... Yeah, the older guy that people would rather moved on to give a hot young free agent a seat there, but he's just still being really good, ergo they're keeping him.
Yep. Robin Miller, I think, also asked Dixon about it after the race on the podium. He asked him about it, and he said, well, you never know. Dixon kind of played it down as well. But let's be real here. If you're anyone but Penske, you've got to be keeping tabs on Newgarden's contract stats because the kid is an absolute stud right now. And
well, I have to feel like I think Ganassi is going to have to be keeping close tabs on him because Penske has such a strong lineup across the board. They got Montoya, Power, Castroneves, and then Pagenaud was seen as the weak link, has now become the best thing in that stable. So they've got four top five tier drivers. Like, literally, this is a team that could on any given Sunday lock out four of the top five.
Absolutely.
And so Ganassi, with their driver lineup, it's not quite as strong. Dixon, of course, is Peter Perfect, and he's an amazing driver. Tony Kanaan's a top six level driver. Max Chilton has done pretty well so far in his rookie season, but he's still feeling his way in. And Charlie Kimball, it's not quite on that level. Harsh to say, good driver, Kim, he's not quite there.
So Kimball's top 10 now. Kimball is 10th overall in the championship right now, ahead of Montoya, ahead of Hinchcliffe, and ahead of Ryan Hunter-Reay. Like, we mock him a lot, but Kimball is now, like, statistically above average. It's really kind of annoying now.
Yeah, so to be fair, he is stepping up now, and it's like, well, who do you get rid of in that space to allow Newgarden in? You know, does he go to Andretti, maybe? Alongside, you know, Hunter-Reay and those guys. That's... I feel like Andretti probably would have more room. King, what do you think on this? Do you think Andretti would probably have more room to accommodate him over there?
I heard there was murmurs that Andretti was hoping for a fifth car, because, like, technically, like, in theory, Andretti's a three-car team with an extremely close partnership with Brian Herta running a fourth car. And there was murmurs that they could be running a fifth car soon. But it's been more leaned over towards maybe Robin Frines moving over from Formula E to IndyCar, but maybe they could go for Newgarden.
Yeah, because, I mean, their lineup at the moment is Munoz, who's very, very strong, very talented. He's bubbling under. He's waiting for that sort of breakout moment. Marco Andretti Autosport probably aren't going to drop him. I mean, that would just be rude, let's be real. And Ryan Hunter-Reay, who's still very strong. He was a champion as recently as 2013, and he's still great quality. And, of course, Alexander Rossi in the Sister 98 car, the Indy 500 champ. They ain't dropping him anytime soon. He's really growing into IndyCar this year.
He's their top driver right now.
He is, exactly. So, you know, be it Frines or Newgarden, where do they go? It's a little bit like the F1 scenario. Are there any seats at the top table right now?
And honestly, stuff Esteban Gutierrez, I would pay good money to see Newgarden in a Haas F1 car right freaking
now.
Yes. Because I think...
Didn't I call that last year on Downforce USA?
You did. I mentioned it on Twitter last night, and I mentioned it here. It was you that called it on Downforce USA over a year ago that Newgarden might be a guy to look out for that seat. And, like, King, is he the best American open wheeler on the planet right now?
Ooh, that's difficult. On a road course, he is great on road courses, but I don't know. I really, like, it's either him or Rossi, to be honest.
And to be fair, King, it's like, this was his first oval win as well. I mean, he was very strong on the ovals last year, too. It's like, he doesn't really have a hole in his game anymore.
No.
Yeah, he was second last year at Iowa, second at Pocono, fifth at Milwaukee, ninth in the Indy 500. He was solid on the ovals as well.
Remember, he led a ton of laps at Milwaukee as well that year. He was the guy to beat that day. I mean, he got nailed by a caution. So,
like Joseph was a part of that, you know, European crowd of Americans racing. Like, he did a season in GP3. He didn't do as spectacular as everyone hoped he would do, but he came over to the States, race for Sam Smith, then, you know, Sarah Fisher, and now Ed Carpenter, and like that is definitely a crowd you want to be with if you want to learn how to, you know, be good on ovals.
Yep, and yep. So yeah, the star power of Joseph Newgarden continues, and also,
I mean, Ed Carpenter is a seriously good oval driver, so what a great mentor to have over there. And I'm looking at these results, you know, he finished 7th in points last year, he's 4th at the moment. Is there an argument to say he doesn't need to move from this team to be a championship contender?
Maybe not.
I mean,
he was eligible to win it on the final round last year.
I mean, that's the same question we asked about Graham Rahal being at Rahal Letterman Lanigan last year.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's like
oh my goodness.
You got adopted the Rahal role.
Yeah, he has. He has. Rahal's not been able to quite back up his form from last year just yet.
Mm-hmm.
Although he's only 8th in points. I mean, literally, they have swapped. Last year, Newgarden was 7th in points. Rahal was 4th. Currently, Newgarden's 4th in points. Rahal's 8th.
Yep, that's one of those things. But, yep, the star power of Joseph Newgarden continues to rise. A magnificent performance. He took the win by just over 4 seconds in the end, only because he was slowing down on the last lap, really. But
And also, sorry, just before we finish this, we haven't even mentioned how old Newgarden is. 25.
Yeah. Only 25. Yeah.
He's 20 friggin' 5. He's easily the youngest of all the top drivers in IndyCar right now.
Yeah, I said it at the start of the season. If I was building an IndyCar team of 5, I'd have Newgarden in it right now, and I wouldn't even hesitate. Like for ability-age ratio, that's ridiculous.
Like, the only people that are younger than him are, you know, the pair at Andretti, Rossi and Munoz, but they're only, like, 24, so that's only, like, a year younger.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's absolutely crazy. Right, quick rundown of the result. Joseph Newgarden winning by just over 4.3 seconds from Willpower. Reminder, Newgarden led 282 laps, which is just ridiculous to even say again, quite frankly. Willpower in second. Shout out to him because he was fantastic the last 10 laps, putting off two mega passes on Simon Pagenaud and Scott Dixon to go from fourth to second in the last 10 laps. Even Power is not normally the happiest man in the world, but even he seemed very amped at the result at the end of the Grand Prix. Power seemed to be, you know, smiley, very happy about that result, and no wonder. I'll talk about that in the championship standings in just a minute, but Power was just was superb there. Second place for him. Scott Dixon, he's quiet, but he's always there. Scott Dixon in third. Great comeback from him after the Road America engine failure. Championship leader Simon Pagenaud in fourth. A quiet day from him, but another very solid result for him in his ridiculous season continuing. Mikaela Loschen, top Honda. Great drive from Mikaela Loschen, the Russian from Schmidt-Peterson Motorsport, in fifth place. The last man on the racing lap. Great job from him as top Honda, ahead of the man that will not go away, Alexander Rossi, in sixth place. A tremendous result for him as well for the Andretti Herta car as well. He led four laps of the Grand Prix going on as well, ahead of Tony Kanaan, who King was not best pleased with said Alexander Rossi during that race.
No, not pleased at all. Like, I remember seeing on Twitter him going up to confront Alex Rossi after the race.
I think it was Tony DeZina that posted a hilarious picture. Yes. Of Kanaan mouth wide open and a very flummoxed Alexander Rossi, and it just told you more than you ever needed to know right there and then.
Yeah, it was not looking good for the guy. And no. They were...
I mean, let's be honest, you don't want to have Vin Diesel walk up to you in the garage area and start threatening you, really, do you?
No.
Let's be real.
He's short and he's angry. He's like I said on Twitter, like Kanaan's going to mess him up. He's like a terrier. He's going to be short and he's going to be really angry. He's going to mess you up.
He's Vin Diesel. He's a guy who goes off and does films where he beats up The Rock. Like, seriously, you're not going to deal with this guy.
No, Kanaan was right. But like, King, can you say some of the words that Sarah Connors was saying as this was taking place?
Oh, God.
Well, we are post-watershed, so, you know.
We've always been post-watershed, to be fair.
probably for the best, to be honest with you.
Go on, King.
Except for that bizarre trying to be PG period from Dre.
Yeah, where that failed for
tech. Let's not talk about that.
Like, she was mainly mad that Tony Kanaan was messing with her son.
Messing up their son.
messing with her son.
I still find it hard to believe that Sarah's like 6 years older than him. It's like, don't tell her I said that on the podcast. She's gonna kill me.
The fan fiction just got a whole lot weirder.
yeah, we'll move on from that swiftly. But yeah, Kanaan in seventh ahead of Sebastian Bourdais. Great job from James Hinchcliffe from the back up into ninth place for him, ahead of Charlie not so average Kimball, who, by the way, had one of the best episodes of The Mayor on Air I've had since I started listening to the show. Kimball is like the nicest man in the world. It's really annoying. Like, he's such a cool guy. It's like,
Mean if any guy has a British round, the British fans will boo him.
Who knows? But yeah, Kimball in 10th, ahead of Takuma Sato, Carlos Munoz, poor Helio Castroneves, who was running right up the front but was screwed by a late caution, put him down in 13th place ahead of Marco Andretti, who somehow is still here, ahead of stateless Jax Hawksworth, Graham Rahal, who was struggling with massive vibrations the entire way through the race, apparently, finished three laps down in 16th place ahead of Gabby Chavez, Ed Carpenter, who had a mechanical problem in the early goings of the race and lost about 15 laps, Max Chilton, who spun out towards the end after getting a bit loose, ahead of Montoya in 20th, who had an engine misfire with about 120 laps to go, ahead of Connor Daly. Now, poor Connor. Apparently, Johnson, we had another case of the Dale Coyne handling problems.
Yeah, this is I read somewhere. I think it may have afflicted Carlos Huertas in 2014. I remember 2015 last year. Pippa Mann suffered from this as well. I remember speaking to her soon after. It was literally a case of I don't even want to talk about it. It was that bad. Like, and Connor Daly had a very similar thing. He said, "Look, it was either that or I was going in the wall. This thing was not happening." So I don't know if the coin cars just struggle with the road course aero kits on the shorter ovals. That appears to be their big problem. They seem to be fine on the bigger ovals. They're definitely all right on the road courses. It's those shorter ovals that run the road course aero kit. I don't know what's going on over there. If this is hiding something deeper over in that camp. But obviously, Daly not able to put his best foot forward at all. And as a consequence, we were treated to a very drunk Lizzie Worth.
Yeah.
Well, King was.
How was that for you, King?
It was interesting.
That reaction to the
Oh, dear God.
Go on, King. I'm going to dig you into this hole and I'm taking you with me.
It was hilarious seeing the other side of her shit posting on Twitter.
just with copious amounts of drinking. Sounds about right to me, quite frankly. But yeah, Conor Daly was about 8 laps down, and then they called it a day, just under half distance. Didn't really see the point in bothering to continue. And poor Ryan Hunter-Reay at the bottom of the field, who caught fire, as one does, in the early goings of that one. That caused the first caution, but Hunter-Reay's miserable season continues. But looking at the championship standings real quick, Simon Pagenaud's lead has actually stayed exactly the same. Amazingly, he still has a 73-point lead in the championship, but the person in second is now Joseph Newgarden. So Newgarden is now second through to his first win of the season, and creeping up on everybody, despite missing a round, Will Power is now third on 334, ahead of Scott Dixon on 321, Helio Castroneves on 318. Tony Kanaan is the pest that will not go away with his angry terrier face on 306. Alexander Rossi still hanging around there in 7th with 286 ahead of Carlos Munoz with 280. Graham Rahal down to 9th on 275. And Charlie Kimball rounding off the top 10 with 275. See, Kimball, slightly above average. What did I tell you? But that will just about do it for the IndyCar section. And let's talk about some other bits and pieces of news before we wrap up this show for the time being. Let's talk about Kimi Raikkonen for a minute here. And King, he has been re-signed for another season, and the internet is entirely pissed.
They're pissed. I would say Raikkonen being around for another year is justified on Raikkonen's side, because Raikkonen's performance...
King, have you now become the voice of God on F1 transfers?
No, someone is echoing and it's not me.
That's probably me and my weird pop shoot. I apologize for that, listeners. I'm actually holding it in my hand right now, supposed to screen it into my table. It's a make
high quality production values here on Motorsport 101.
Of course, we're real professionals on this show, but carry on.
Yeah, I'd say it's deserved on Raikkonen's point. For like up until recently, he was second in the championship. Now he's dropped down to third with, you know, Ross with Hamilton coming back up, but it's. I think a lot of fans are disappointed because they wanted to see someone new at Ferrari.
Exactly. I think that's what it boils down to. I think I wish more people, like, I wish people, instead of, you know, being dishonest and, you know, trying to talk Perez into this seat, I'd be much better off if they just were just honest enough to admit, let's just get someone new in the car. And Raikkonen's been kind of been the second fiddle in that team for the last 3 years now. But, like, he's not like he was terrible in 2014, I'll give him that, but 2015 he was okay. This year he's been genuinely pretty good. 4 podium finishes, you know, he's finished a lot, most of his races in the top 5 this year. Sure, he's not won a Grand Prix, but he's done above and I think beyond what Ferrari have expected of him for this season. So, you know, maybe Raikkonen still has a little bit left in him. So for me personally, I don't know how you feel about this, Johnson, but I know you're the Perez guy, so you're going to be a little bit miffed, I'm sure, but I feel like Raikkonen has done more than enough to warrant another year in his contract, because I don't think on performance reasons there's any good reason to get rid of him right now.
Well, firstly, I'm also a Nico Hülkenberg guy, so I'm the guy who's very much used to not expecting anything in terms of drivers getting chances at big teams. I mean, seriously, come on. But to be honest with you, I think what's surprising about this announcement is that I think Kimi Raikkonen's re-signing last year was probably less deserved.
Yeah,
it's kind of strange how last year he was very much second fiddle to Vettel. He wasn't getting that many strong results. He didn't seem that kind of fast, although this is Raikkonen. He is so laid back. He's basically horizontal. Last year, people were going, oh, there's Perez, there's Hülkenberg, there's Grosjean, there's all these great drivers. And they've re-signed Raikkonen? Do they not want to go after the constructor? Do they not want to have a decent backup And, like, based on the form of last year, Raikkonen was kind of off the pace, really. So people were confused about it. This time around, I think people are just purely frustrated because they want to see a young driver up there. But the irony is, this time around, he deserves it more than he did last year. It's actually paid off for them. They've given him an extended contract, and he's racing even better than ever at Ferrari. So he entirely has driven himself into contention for that seat in 2017. Just frustrating for everyone else. I mean, Perez is driving very strongly this year, I'd have to say, including the end of last season. He's having one of the best stints of his entire career. Grosjean's in a good spot now over at Haas, the de facto Ferrari B team. I wonder if Ferrari are just saying, it's fine, we see you young guys over there, you're there, your time will come, but right now we've got no reason to break up this happy marriage. We've got Vettel, one of the greatest of all time at this current era. We've got Raikkonen, who's driving better than ever. The two get on really well. There's a great harmony, great vibe in the garage. No reason to split them up just yet and go for an unproven entity. So, and last year, people were kind of going, really? But this year, I think, to be honest with you, when you put all the frustration aside, you kind of say, no, fair enough.
How much do you want to say, I'm all for Sergio Perez, why hasn't this happened yet, and be really angry?
Well, I mean, I'm the Perez guy. I'd love to see him at Ferrari, but, like, I know how Formula One works, man. And at this point in time, I'm almost enjoying Perez. As like, I mean, Perez had that run at McLaren, and it backfired badly. Like, this is, it's quite funny. Like, for example, I remember being upset when Hülkenberg was overlooked for Lotus in 2014 in favour of Pastor Friggin Maldonado. In the end, it worked out perfectly because Lotus had their worst season. So, Formula One's strange like that.
Mm.
Yeah, exactly. And Formula One is strange like that. You know what I mean? So. Mm-hmm. Hey, you know what? Perez in the Force India for now. That's cool. You know what? All good.
Yep. Fine by me as well. Fine by me as well. And a couple more bits of major news. We've mentioned Top Gear a fair bit on this podcast as time has gone on. And
we've basically continued. Do you remember you used to do like a sort of Dre Talks review series on the Top Gear episodes? Mm-hmm. But yeah, unfortunately, it chose the series where Clarkson decided to violently assault a member of staff. And then that all fell apart. But we've kind of continued that tradition onto the podcast, haven't we?
Yeah, we have, and it's always been a spiritual successor, and we're talking about Top Gear some more now, and the series came to an end at the end of last week. I mean, for me, I don't know how you guys feel about the series, but having watched all six episodes now, like, I think it was a pretty good season, for all said and done. I mean, there was no episode that completely blew me away. Like, if I had my old review system, I don't think any episode would have been a 9 or a 10 out of 10. But I think I don't think there was an episode that was flat out bad. I think they were all good to great episodes for the most part. And I feel that, for me, and I think I've said this on many social outlets before already, but I feel like Matt LeBlanc, Chris Harris and Rory Reid is the future of Top Gear going forward. And I think, especially in the case of Rory Reid standing out as a breakout star, I feel that, you know, there is a lot of positive to take away from this reboot of Top Gear. I mean, I don't know how you guys feel about it, but that's the impression I get after watching this series.
I think, to be honest with you, the big problem started with the fact that probably the weakest episode of the entire series was the first one.
Absolutely.
Which was the one they absolutely had to blow out of the park.
Mm.
There were two big problems here. Well, three big problems. Number one, as I just said, the poor first episode. Number two, the fact that this was the David Moyes era of Top Gear. This was the show that was... This was the series that was never, ever going to have a hope in hell of standing out as the one being immediately after the greatest era in Top Gear history had come to an end in such bitter circumstances. And especially with the fact that the shadow still looms. The Grand Tour still hasn't broadcast a single episode. Yeah. And yet an entire series of Top Gear has come and gone. And they've already gone through a new replacement host. They're looking for another one, or may not have one at all. So that was always going to be a problem. I mean, I kind of said going into it, it looked like it had the potential to be a pretty decent car show. The problem is it's called Top Gear. So the expectation was just going to be off the charts. I mean, I said this last time out. With old new Top Gear, they had time to experiment with the format. You had, you know, James May wasn't even in the very first series. They had a guy, the guy whose name I can't even remember.
Jason,
he was that much
Dore,
of a blistering...
Jason
Dore, there you go. Yeah, I've got some great used car bargains. Excellent. Anyway, so May turned up for the second series, so they kind of had room to experiment. They had a good three or four series where they were really finding their feet, working out which features worked, which didn't, quickly working out consumer advice stuff was boring and people wanted to see stuff blow up, caravans get destroyed, and then race across Europe in cheap old cars and supercars and everything, and they kind of started to hit a home run around Series 5, and they were kind of on from there. But this new Top Gear was never going to have that. They had to hit the ground running. Weak first episode, and Chris Evans not gelling as a natural host kind of crippled it, to be honest with you. And as you've said, there was a lot to like in the new series. I mean, someone took out of the episode and put as a separate clip online Chris Harris's review of the NSX from the last episode
of
the latest series.
Shout out to 50 Bucks on Twitter, one of the real good guys on Twitter. One of the nicest guys you can talk to. He'll record almost anything if you ask him nicely. And he does a tremendous job of getting these clips. He's also one of the nicest guys you can talk to on Twitter as well. So shout out to Kai if you're listening to us. You're a tremendous dude. But yeah, carry on, Johnson. I had to get that one in real quick.
Yeah, absolutely agree. He cut the segment out with Chris Harris reviewing the new NSX. Now, I love the new Honda NSX anyway, so I was excited to see this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Harris, we all know, literally, Harris was the one we were all excited about going into
absolutely.
This. This was the one... when the bloated lineup of hosts was a very bad idea, but to be honest with you, I kind of got the sense that they were throwing stuff at a wall and seeing what stuck. They were like, well, let's go with the people that they kind of know from old Top Gear, like Sabina Schmitz, the people they kind of know from F1 with Eddie Jordan, Chris Evans, he likes cars, he's loud and stuff, and he'll be good. Matt LeBlanc, people know him from Friends, hey, he's cool. Chris Harris, he's an actual car guy, and he's really good at what he does, so, but people don't really know him outside of that, maybe, even though... his reviews of like the triple test of the LaFerrari, McLaren P1 and the Porsche 918 have got nearly 2 million hits on YouTube. So, and then let's go with Roy Reed, who's the talent that, let's be honest, we didn't really know a hell of a lot. We were making jokes about him when he was announced
Random
coming in.
Black and yet guy.
Exactly. He's been the absolute find of this series. He's kind of come out of nowhere in the same way that, let's be honest, James May and Richard Hammond kind of came out of nowhere. Originally, when Top Gear started, they were the ones that were kind of the unknowns. Clarkson was the one coming in with the big, you know, with the previous record. But they've kind of hit it out of the park. But to be honest with you, as I say, this series was always kind of doomed from the start. It had some good bits. It was very inconsistent, though. And I think having such a weak first episode kind of ruined it to me. And Evans, I think, was a big, big problem. Because it wasn't like a case of, oh, I can sit through his segments... just so I can hopefully get to see some Roy Reed and Chris Harris. Having them on Extra Gear to start off was a big mistake. And I think they must have learned very quickly that people are like, oh no, wait a minute, people are liking the guys that we're sticking on the bonus show on, what, BBC Three or something? So they quickly had to try and adjust things as they go and tried to give them a bit more screen time, which was very well done. I think LeBlanc was very good, you know, very chilled out. He fitted naturally, but to be honest with you, I mean, there's a potential sexual assault case lingering over Chris Evans as well, as far as I know. So, I mean, King, I don't know if you kind of felt the same way on this one, but it felt to me like Evans was kind of too much of a negative, and there was just, like for all the good that like Harris and Reed and LeBlanc was doing, it was just like, at times, Evans's delivery was so... ear-scrapingly annoying and intense that it just drove people away. It was like, shut up, shut up, shut up, I can't take this, and it was enough to drive people away. And it didn't matter how good Roy Reed and Chris Harris were, it was the card was already marked.
Yeah, like basically with Evans being the face of the show, there was no way around it. Like, you couldn't focus on Harrison Reed because like any way to get to them, it would be through Chris Evans. Any introduction to any of their segments, anything, it would be through Chris Evans, and it wouldn't work anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. So it to me, like, Dre, I feel like you're on the same page as this one. I think new Top Gear does have potential as a decent, entertaining car show, but we've talked about this before.
Absolutely.
A LeBlanc Harris Reed trio hosting it, you can get rid of the others. Not that they were particularly bad, although I think Eddie Jordan sitting randomly on a train was about his contribution for the entire series, so it was just enough to put him on the poster. It's a bit like when they put like a major actor on a film poster and then he gets killed in the opening credits. Just doesn't make any sense. So I feel like Evans's card was marked. Like, he needed this series, like the final episodes, to smash it out of the park. But from minute one, it was kind of doomed.
It was kind of doomed. I mean, Eddie Jordan was like Jada Pinkett in Scary Movie 2. He didn't even make the opening credits. quite frankly, which was an ideal. And, you know, this was Evans' baby from the start, really. He was given essentially creative control, and this was meant to be his magnum opus. And, you know, it's... it did not turn out that way. I think Evans came across a little bit too overbearing. I think he came across as a guy that tried a little bit too hard and that he had to be the center of attention because he felt like it was his show. And I felt like with as much as Top Gear's most important piece was Clarkson by a mile, it never felt like it was Clarkson's show.
No,
like,
it was always all three of them. It was the three exactly. as a collective.
It was the three as a collective. James May and Richard Hammond were tremendous in their own right. And this felt like the Chris Evans penis extension. It really did. And it had, like any guy waving his penis around all the time, like nobody wants to see it, and it just ruins everything. And, okay, ruins maybe a harsh term. I mean, even the little things like Evans wearing the same clothes on every episode got annoying. His voice was annoying. He was trying way too hard. His interview technique was terrible across the show. The interviews were shit for the most part of this series.
He was basically shouting at you, and it was just like, no, shut up. You don't need to do this. Just relax.
Yeah, and there's no getting around it. The show lost 66% of its audience in the space of 6 weeks. The last episode did 1.9 million viewers. And I know it was competing against the France-Iceland game on ITV during Euro 2016 in the quarterfinals.
But as we made the point last week, that was still the lowest ever rating for an episode of Top Gear.
That's unacceptable. Like, Top Gear did 4.3 against the World Cup final in 2010. So that excuse doesn't quite wash. And people have clearly made a conscious decision to, you know, they gave it a chance. A lot of people did give it to us because when the opening show did 6 million viewers.
Yeah.
So people were willing to give this a go. They were curious. They wanted to see how it turned out. And 4 million people said, you know what? I'm not coming back for this by the time week 6 came around. And again, we've said it before. Like, I think Evans bore the brunt of it. He was the face of the failure. And Evans, I think, had to step down, and not just so much of this supposed backdated potential child abuse scandal that's come through, or sex abuse scandal that's come through in the last week or so from pages like Jalopnik and The Telegraph reporting this as well, that Evans may have, you know, sexually abused someone in the 90s when he was hosting TFI Friday, but how much that relates to him quitting, we don't know. We can only speculate on that, but Evans at the forefront had to go. Apparently the BBC's not going to replace him, which is interesting, but even though they've released ads or adverts saying that, you know, he may do. But it's a shame. I don't like seeing any guy lose his job. I don't take pleasure in that most of the time, in brackets. I don't like seeing a guy lose his job, and I think Evans did genuinely want the show to be a success, and I have no question in that, but sometimes you got to hold your hands up and say when it isn't working. And I'm glad he stepped down, because I did not want to see him again on the show. I felt like, you know, he was dragging the quality of the show down. I'm, like I said before, I'm all for a LeBlanc, Harris, and Reed big three. I don't mind if they use Eddie Jordan and Sabine Schmitz every once in a while as additional roles. I think Harris can do those long form films about, you know, challenges and whatnot. I don't see any reason why he couldn't be able to do that. Alongside Rory Reed, who again has got more charisma than anyone else on the show, bar none. So why not? And I feel like the health of Top Gear is damaged, but I think they can salvage something. I think it's worth trying at least one more series to see whether a changed lineup can have an impact. And I know there's still people taking bets on the host for the new series. I know the chef James Martin, I think, is Bookie's favourite. I've seen Dermot O'Leary's name thrown around because of him hosting the Getaway Car on BBC One with the Top Gear affiliation with that. I've seen Philip Glenister's name thrown around a little bit still as well from Life on Mars. And, you know, who knows where that, who knows? But I think it's worth at least one more go. And when's the Grand Tour starting? I need to know, Amazon. Please tell me straight away so I can, you know, totally legally watch your shit. but before we wrap up the show, a sad story came through on Saturday regarding the world of motorsport, the passing of a true legend of the sport, and that's Carl Haas. And I know, King, you wanted to talk about this. The floor is yours, my friend.
Yeah, like, admittedly, me and Connors had a moment where we kind of
noticed, we kind of noticed among ourselves that there's a whole bunch of new F1 fans moving over to IndyCar. And when I read the news, like, the first thing in the comment section was like, oh, he'll never see how great his F1 team was. Ugh. And it was cringeworthy that a whole bunch of people don't know who Carl Haas even was. That mm-hmm. Carl Haas was, you know, one of those iconic team principals, and his team, Newman Haas, was one of the most formidable. I think Roger Penske called him his fiercest competitor, and for the longest time it was Penske and Newman Haas. And I think they had 107 wins total in their run from the 80s up until 2011, and they have won 8 drivers' championships. They won in 84 with Mario Andretti, 91 with Michael, 93 with Nigel Mansell, 2002 with Cristiano D'Amato, and of course, the reason why I remember them best, the 4 Champ Car titles he won with Sebastian Bourdais.
Awesome. And
this team was literally the big two, Penske and Newman Haas up until 96, and the Thunderbolt Ganassis with them winning the championship that year with Jimmy Vassar and then rookie Alex Zanardi.
Mm-hmm.
And probably they didn't handle the move in the merger in 2008 well. They had the second best rookie in the 2007 season with Graham Rahal finishing 5th in the championship and Bourdais winning the championship, but you know, Bourdais moved on to F1. They re-signed one of their former drivers, Bruno. For Bourdais, they got Justin Wilson.
Mm.
And Wilson and Graham, they were able to get the 2 final wins of Newman Haas, but it was downhill from there. Their last season was 2011, and they signed rookie James Hinchcliffe, but the team didn't have the sponsorship to, you know, buy a DW12.
Ugh. Sad for such a legendary mark to go down like that, but very much so a very important figure in, you know, North America and just motorsport in general. So rest in peace, Carl Haas. On behalf of all three of us, our thoughts go out to Gene and the family.
Gene and Carl Haas are not related in any way. I should just say that now. Yeah.
Whoopsie! I always thought they were. That's my bad. That's my bad. that's one for the blooper reel again.
Paul Haas did run his own Formula One. He did have the original Haas Formula One team. Funnily enough,
yes,
that's where the race comes from. Back in 1985.
Thanks, Johnson, for covering up my failure. I appreciate that. I take one for the team, my friend. I do really appreciate that. But just before we go, a couple of shout-outs. First of all, shout-out to Jack Webb, who's our new Patreon backer. So shout-out to you, sir. Thank you very much. You're very kind of us on Twitter. He said, and I quote, "All it took was one 40-minute conversation with us to prove to us that you needed to give us some money," which is the best conversation I've ever heard in my life. So thanks a lot, Jack. Much appreciated. Also, a massive thanks to Debbie Franjdakis for showing off the very first Motorsport 101 t-shirt that is out there. You can see it on my Instagram page at Harrison101. You can check that out. So thanks a lot, Debbie. You're an absolute superstar. Many, many thanks for that. Those guys who are $10 Patreon backers at the end of the month, I will sort you out a shirt as well. So Andrew and I think Jake Callahan, if you're listening, I'll get in touch with you in the next couple of weeks or so. That is a promise on my end. So thanks to you guys for that. Now, this is not the only episode you're going to be getting this week. On Sunday afternoon, we announced the first Motorsport 101 International Fantasy Draft. So 5 general managers, me, Adam Johnson, Ryan King, Matthias Canario from Mystery Science Theater F1, and Chris Cook from Cook Productions 1. We sat down in a room, we got pieces of paper and pens, and we put every racing driver out there into one giant pot, and we took 5 teams of 8 super teams full of some of the best racing talents in the world, and Valtteri Bottas. And as it turns out, we had a lot of fun with it, and we can't wait to show off the results. By the time you're listening to this episode, you've probably already seen the preview video on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/motorsport101. And if you haven't, get over there already and subscribe. So we'll talk all about the rules on that video over there. The actual draft itself, if by the time you're listening to this, it would most likely have already gone live on Early Access, but it will be public next Monday, so that's July the 18th. You will see, or you will have the chance to listen to the entire draft in full. It's about a minute. It's about an hour, 15 minutes long. So yeah, you're getting two episodes for the price of one this week. And by the time that episode goes public on July 18th, you'll have the chance to vote on our teams. My team was blatantly the best. That's a disclaimer right now. There's no arguments here.
Seriously, come on.
Look, I'm sorry. I'm competing against a crazy cook, King's team of and you breaking your own transatlantic policies to take. How dare you?
Spoilers, come on.
That's a minor spoiler. It wasn't even that big a pick. Damn you. But
let's not give away the fact that I was the monk that went for
I like that nobody even believed that. Like, if you're listening to this episode right now, there's no way anybody in hell actually believed what you just said. Not in 1,000 years. But like I said, the draft episode will go live on Monday.
Definitely
the
18th. No one will believe that you picked.
Deafening silence. Crickets could be heard amongst that discussion. So you'll see. Also, you'll see on YouTube early what happened in the first two rounds when the champions were not eligible. It's a very interesting top 10. And a couple of real shock picks in there, which I think you'll be very impressed by, especially from Matt. But that's all I'll say regarding that. The first two rounds will be on YouTube next week. But bear in mind, to find out what happened when the champions became available, you've got to listen to the full show. So if you're very loyal to us, then you wouldn't have a problem at all now, will you? But that will just about do it for Motorsport 101 this week. Massive thanks, as always, to Chris as well, and Matt for showing up. And, of course, Adam and Ryan for coming here as well. We're getting very close to 50 episodes. We've got something special to announce for that next week as well. So until then, I've been Andre Harrison. He's been Ryan King and Adam Johnson. You can follow us at Harrison101HD, at AJ_Bumblesports, and at Ryan Eric King. Until next time, thanks for listening. Sayonara.
Like, I'm not ready.
You are the world champion!